You are listening to the services of the First Baptist Church in Dallas. This is the pastor bringing the morning message entitled, The Face of God. The sermon for this morning is prepared out of the 32nd chapter of the book of Genesis. Now we have opportunity at this hour to take up where I left off last Sunday morning. I got halfway through the message last Sunday morning. So we will finish briefly by summary the word of last Sunday and then come to the message for this hour in the 32nd chapter of Genesis. Now, last Sunday morning, we left off at the 29th chapter of Genesis. So this morning, briefly, let's look at the 30th chapter. The message of last Sunday morning largely was centered around the building of the home of Jacob. Laban, the father of Rachel, had made a contract with Jacob that if Jacob would work for Laban 7 years as his reward, he would be given Rachel to wife. But Laban, when time came to fulfill that covenant, refused to do so, saying that in his country it was not the custom for the younger girl to be married before first the older daughter was married. So Jacob was given Leah instead by stealth, by subterfuge. So you had the situation, unhappy, of Leah, who is the wife of Jacob, unwanted and disliked. And last Sunday morning we spoke of these things in the building of the home of Jacob. Now, in order to have Rachel, whom he loved, he worked 7 more years, 14. But he was given Rachel at the end of the first 7 years, then promised to work 7 more in order to win her. But he was given Rachel at the end of the first 7 years. So when you come to the 25th verse of the 30th chapter of Genesis, Jacob has been in Haran and has been working for Laban for 14 years. Now, Rachel was not the mother of a child. Leah had one son after another. A compensation of God for the sorrow of her life. But Rachel had no child. And Jacob prayed. And God answered her prayer. And Joseph was born at the end of the 14 years. Now this 25th verse, and it came to pass, when Rachel had borne Joseph, that Jacob said unto Laban, send me away, that I may go unto mine own place and to my country. Give me my wives and my children, for whom I have served thee, and let me go, for thou knowest my service which I have done thee. So at the end of the 14 years, when Joseph is born, as soon as the wife and and the child are able to make the long and fatiguing journey. Why, Jacob proposes to go back to the land of Canaan. Now, when he said that, it was alarming news for Laban. Look at the next verse, the 27th verse. And Laban said unto him, I pray thee, if I have found favor in thine eyes, tarry. For I have learned by experience that the Lord hath blessed me for thy sake. When Laban hears from Jacob that Jacob plans to return to the land of Canaan, he is alarmed. For God greatly blessed him, he says, because of the presence of Jacob. So he pleads with Jacob to stay with him. All right, Jacob sees an opportunity there to drive a bargain with Laban. And he drives it. And that is the strangest bargain you ever saw in your life. It was one of those things where both men thought that they had outwitted the other. There in the 31st and 32nd verses, Jacob says, I'll stay with you and I'll work for you if all of the spotted rain rings straight, all of the off-colored of the cattle are mine, and then all the rest are yours. Well, Laban just chuckled to himself, practically all of those goats and sheep over there are either black or white. You don't have many spotted ones and ring-streaked ones. Very few. And yet that was the bargain. All the spotted ones and ring-tailed ones. Well, they're going to be Jacob's. And all the rest of them that were normal were going to be Laban's. Well, sir, Laban just chuckled to himself. That is the best bargain he ever drove in his life. So he went away just happy, thinking he surely outwitted Jacob. Now, on the other side, it is just the opposite. Jacob knew that he had a scheme whereby he was going to get all of those offspring to be spotted, ring-streaked, brown, off-colored. So he's just laughing up his sleeve about how he was going to outwit Laban. Did you ever see such goings-on in your life? That's one thing about the Bible. When it presents the character of the man, it has no respect to persons. You see the fellow just as he is. And you're looking at Jacob here just as he is. Just like you look at David as he was. Just like you look at Simon Peter as he was. Just like you look at all of them just as they were. Well, that's the way the Bible presents it. The Bible is a wonderful delineation of human character. The inside of the man as well as the outside. So the thing goes along, and Jacob certainly succeeds in what he thought he could do. He got practically all of those calves and all of those kids and all of those lambs to be spotted or ring-streaked or brown. It was an unusual affair, all written there in that 30th chapter of the book of Genesis. Then you come to the 31st chapter. And there the Lord God speaks to Jacob. Jacob is capable of infinite religious dedication. Esau was capable of no religious recognitions. He was just a fine animal. Some men seem to be that way. You can pray for them forever. They could go to church forever. You can talk to them about the Lord forever. And they are the same dull clod that they were to begin with. That's one of the strangest things and I sit in the same household. There will be two people in the same household, one of whom will vibrate at the hand of God. His heart will be a card upon which God can play. And there may be in that same household a blood brother or a blood sister, and they are as dead and impervious to spiritual influences and spiritual appeals as though they were animals. Now, with all of the weakness that you find in Jacob, supplanter, schemer, he had in him those infinite possibilities to be made into a prince of God. And now the time's coming. And there in Haran, where he's outwitting his uncle, scheming and plotting and planning, and Laban changing Jacob's wages 10 times, he says, and Jacob doing everything he can to keep his head above the water, while he's over there in that country, while the Lord speaks to him. Now look at the 3rd verse of the 31st chapter of Genesis. And the Lord said unto Jacob, return unto the land of thy fathers and to thy kindred, and I will be with thee. Time to get out of this, Jacob. Time to get out of it. Now you know you have there a little parable of life between the Passover deliverance and the entrance into Canaan. There were the long years of the wilderness wandering. Between the time that God appeared to Jacob at Bethel and the time that God sends him back to the house of God in the tents of his fathers, there are these 20-some-odd years in Haran. Did you ever think of your own life? We're like that. Between the time of our conversion and the time of our final rest, our entrance into Canaan, there's all of this that goes on in our lives and in our times and in our days and in our homes. All the wanderings and the overthrowings and the foilings of God's children. Just look at your own life. How much of regret and how much of soul bitterness and how much of fault and failure. All of us are like that. Every one of us. So the Lord comes and speaks to Jacob and says, Jacob, it's time to go back to Bethel. Now, I suppose that God could see. It says there in the closing verse of the 30th chapter of Genesis, and this man Jacob increased exceedingly, and had much cattle, and maidservants, and men servants, and camels and asses. I suppose God could see that Jacob was losing the pilgrim spirit. He was affluent, increased in the land where he lived. When God said to the children of Israel to go back out of Babylon to Palestine, very few of them left. Very few of them went. Very few of them returned. They were prospering in Babylon. They had business houses, and they had all kinds of interests and holdings. They weren't interested in God anymore. And they weren't interested in Jerusalem anymore. And they weren't interested in the house of the Lord anymore. And they stayed in Babylon. They lost the pilgrim spirit. I would think that God was thinking that Jacob was losing that. You know, I don't know what. I don't know why. But I can tell you, since I've become pastor of the First Baptist Church in Dallas, that there's not anything that takes people away from God so much as affluence. Well, the accumulation of this world's goods, it does something to people. It corrodes. There are exceptions to it. There are a few well-to-do rich people who stay devout and humble and close to the Lord, but there are not many of them. and their children, hardly any of them. Oh, I suppose the reason so many of us are poor is because it's the only way God can keep us humble and close to Him. Well, the Lord sure keeping me poor and humble. No, we have enough. Most of us do. But that thing, God could see it. And the Lord said to Jacob, now get up and go back to the tents and to the lands and to the house of your father that I promised you. And this isn't your home. It's in Canaan. Now, I want to point out something here in the Bible that I think is always true. Always true about a call of God. How do you know the Lord wants you to do such and such? Now, let me show you a certain way to tell. In my humble persuasion, whenever you have a true call of God, it will be corroborated by outward circumstances, experiences. Things will happen that will corroborate God's call in your heart. Now look here. And the Lord said unto Jacob, return unto the land of thy fathers and to thy kindred. Now look at that previous verse. Jacob beheld the countenance of Laban, and behold, it was not toward him as before. And he said unto his wives, Rachel and Leah, and called them out secretly into the field. And he said, I see your father's countenance, that it is not toward me as before. You see, God said to him on the inside of his heart, you go back to Bethel. You go back to Palestine. You go back to Canaan. Then on the outside, he looked at the circumstances of life. And they said, you ought to go back. You ought to get out. You ought to move on. Now, let me apply that in the little moment that I have. If a boy says to me, God's called me to preach, and he's the only one that believes that God has called him to preach, I don't think God has called him. I think God's call will be corroborated by outside circumstances. He won't be the only one that'll know it. There'll be other people who'll feel that same thing. Now, next Sunday, we're going to dedicate that morning's hour, as we always do, to the memory of the great pastor of this church. It was the church that ordained Dr. Truett. He wasn't going to be a preacher. He was going to be a lawyer. He's getting ready to be a lawyer. But the people said, no, God has called you to preach. And it was the people who, though Dr. Truett felt that in his soul and knew it in his heart, it was the people who so greatly and largely corroborating it almost forced him into an ordination hour. Now, I think that'll be true in all of your life. You ought to do something. God calls you to do something. Then there will be corroborating circumstances that indicate it. Now, I have a time to elaborate on that in a thousand multitudinous, multifarious, different instances of your life. But it's all the time like that. When you ought to do something, God will send corroborating evidences that it ought to be done. Just like this building over here that we have. Who would ever have thought that that thing would turn as it did? Yet it was the thing for us to do because of the hand of God, the moving of the circumstances of life. There will be in all of the great choices that God would have us make, There will be outside corroborating circumstances. If a man will take God as his partner, I don't care what business you're in, if you'll take God as your partner, you'll have a certain answer every time you come to a great decision. Shall I buy this property? Shall I build this building? Shall I expand my business? Shall I accept this position? Shall I move to this new location? All of these things, God will give you a certain answer. It'll be first on the inside of your heart. You'll have a conviction. And that conviction will be corroborated by circumstances on the outside. That's the sure way to make a right decision. And that's the way it happened here in the life of Jacob. And the Lord said, Jacob, go back. And he looked at the face of Laban. And from the look of the countenance of the face of Laban, Jacob said, that's right, I'd sure better go back. They both go together. Now we must hasten. So we come to the message of this morning's hour. In the 32nd chapter of the book of Genesis now. Genesis 32. Jacob's on his way back. And Jacob went on his way. And the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, this is the hosts of God. This is God's host. And he called the name of that place Mahanaim. 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 That means two hosts. Now, you know, let's just look at that for a moment. Just for a moment. Do you ever wonder about those things? How did that happen? That's all it said. Nothing else. No explanation. No anything. Just that. Was it around some turn of a mountain pass? And Jacob saw the two hosts of God meeting. Well, how was it? Did they meet one at a time? Angel facing angel. Was it two by two? Were they four abreast? Were they marching to some celestial music? Were they singing? He went on his way, and he met the hosts of God. When you read in your Bible, the Lord of hosts, that doesn't mean the Lord of great armies here. It means the Lord of the hosts of heaven. The Lord of hosts. Wonder what they look like. And now may I say the other question. I wonder if angelic hosts pass us today. I wonder if we meet them on the way and don't know it. I wonder if sometimes when we're blue and down and discouraged and defeated and we think we're alone and by ourselves, I wonder if the mountains are filled with horses and chariots of fire round about us, but we can't see them. And I wonder if God's angelic hosts meet us and pass us on the way, and we don't realize it. Well, it's something to think of, isn't it? And he's on his way, and the angels of God met him. And he called the name of the place, the two hosts, the two bands, Mahanaim. Now, as he comes back home, with what fear and trepidation does he face that awful encounter with Esau? He sent messengers to Edom, to the land of Seir, down there south of the Dead Sea, to the country where Esau dwells. And he says, I'm coming back home. And those messengers return to Jacob breathlessly with the terrible news. We came to thy brother Esau. And we told him that you were coming. And he arose and he armed 400 of his men to meet you, and they're on the way now. And Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, because the last time he saw his brother, the last thing he heard from the lips of his brother was, "I will kill my brother Jacob." And here Jacob is returning to the land of his fathers, and as he comes nigh the border of Palestine, this terrible news confronts him. Esau is on his way with 400 armed men. And what does Jacob do? Now I want you to look at this. He can't go back. That tower of Mizpah between him and Laban says they'll never trespass. Jacob won't go to Laban, and Laban won't bother Jacob. The tower of Mizpah bars the way. On either side are robber tribes. If he shows the least sense of vacillation or of fear, they're eager to seize the rich beauty, take away his family, sell him as slaves, take away all of his substance, destroy his own life. But to go ahead is to face apparent and inevitable ruin with Esau's armed men. Well, what does he do? He did just like you and I do if we love the Lord. You don't meet a situation like that if you're a Christian, that you don't bow your knees and pray. And I guess even an infidel will do it. But certainly God's child does it. He prays. And may I make the comment there that here again, maybe the will of God and the distresses that overtake you in your life are not without purpose and not without good. Maybe they are to drive us to our knees. And Jacob couldn't go back, couldn't turn to the right or the left, and to go on was to face apparent destruction. He got on his knees, he bowed, and he prayed. Now I want you to look at this prayer. This is one of the finest little examples of how we ought to pray, of any little prayer I've found in the Bible. It's only about 1, 2, 3. It's only 3 verses long. Now you look at it. He starts off with a promise, and he closes with a promise. In the 9th verse, Jacob said, "O God of my father Abraham, the God of my father Isaac, the Lord which saidst unto me." And then he quotes what God had promised him, what God had told him. "Return, and I'll deal well with thee." Now look at the 12th verse. Does the same thing again. "O God, thou saidst, I will surely do thee good, and make thy seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude." When he gets down on his knees, first thing he does, and the last thing he does, he quotes a promise of God. He reminds the Lord what the Lord had said. Now that's a good way to pray. "Lord, you said in thy word, thou didst say in the holy book." Then just quote a great promise. Just to remind the Lord, "Lord, look on this page here. look here. Look what God said. If my people, which are called by my name, shall humble themselves and pray, then will I, these great promises of God. All right, look at the second thing there. That next verse, the 10th verse. Look what he says about himself. I am not worthy. Isn't that a good way? Isn't that a good position for a man to be in when he's talking to God? I am not worthy. When Abraham made his appeal, he said, behold, I have taken upon myself to speak unto thee, I who am but dust and ashes. I am not worthy. Coming as a suppliant, bowed down. And then his appeal, deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother Esau. For I fear him. Nothing wrong in being honest with God, is there? Just tell him. For I'm afraid of him, lest he'll come and smite me and the mother and the children. I'm afraid, Lord. I'm afraid. I don't know where to turn. I don't know what to do. I'm afraid, Lord. I'm afraid. Tell him. Just bow down before him and lay your whole heart before God. Tell him. I repeat, that's one of the finest examples of real prayer. You'll find the whole book, this little appeal of Jacob. So, after the prayer, he divides that family and flock, doing the best that he knew how to spare them. And at the brook Jabbok, the river Jabbok, at the ford of the Jabbok River, pouring from the east to the west into the Jordan River. He's on the eastern side of the Jordan. At the Jabbok River, small stream, and at a ford, why, he sends everybody over. Sends his families. Sends his children. Sends his flocks and his herds. Sends everything over. And he's there by himself alone. Now, the 23rd verse. And Jacob was left alone. And there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. And when that man saw that he prevailed not against Jacob, he touched the hollow of his thigh. And the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And the angel said, let me go, for the day breaketh. And Jacob said, I will not let thee go, except thou bless me. And he said unto him, what is thy name? And he said, Jacob. And he said, thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and hast prevailed. Jacob asked him and said, tell me, I pray thee, thy name. And he said, wherefore is it that thou dost ask after my name? And he blessed him there. And Jacob called the name of the place Peniel. Peniel, face of God. For I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. And as he passed over Penuel, another spelling of the same thing, the sun rose upon him, and he halted upon his thigh. A cripple. Therefore the children of Israel eat not of the sinew which shrank, which is upon the hollow of the thigh, unto this day, because he touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh in the sinew that shrank. Now, for this little moment that remains, we come to the heart of this message. First, it is the messenger, the angel, it is the angel of Jehovah that wrestles with Jacob. It is God that's doing it. It's not Jacob picked a fight with the angel of Jehovah. but the angel of Jehovah has seized Jacob. And that's the way many times it is in the life of a Christian. God confronts you. You. Here you are, going on your way, following your will, these plans and ambitions and programs and all of the things of this self-life. That's you. And God confronts you. And God wrestles with you. Is this an actual physical thing? It is both. It is an actual physical thing here because he halted on his thigh, the sinew shrank. And the children of Israel do not eat that part of the animal that corresponds to the sinew that shrank in Jacob's thigh to this day. I know it was physical, actual, just like it happened here in the Bible, because of the actual crippling of Jacob. But it also is a great spiritual reality. God confronts Jacob. All of those things of him, they have to die, have to be crucified. The sinew of this selfish life of ours has to shrink before the Christ life can live within us. God confronts Jacob. God does it. And Jacob resists. Did you ever know what that was? And Jacob resists. I don't want to do that, Lord. I don't want to obey, Lord. That's where the civil war is. I got my mind made up. I got my plan. I've got my program. I've got my wish and my heart set. Lord. And that's the struggle. And God didn't overcome him either. Jacob was so resisting and no humor to yield. God struggled with him, and he struggled against God all night long. And he didn't prevail. And when the day began to break, it was time for the angel to depart. And when the angel saw that he didn't prevail, he touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh, and it shrank and weak. Crippled. There he lay, overcome. And then the old Jacob died. Weak and crippled, left there, facing the Marah. Oh, what would it be? With Esau and the armed men, he there, crippled, left alone. And in desperation, he clung to the angel of the Lord and said, "Don't leave me like this. Don't leave me like this. I have come to the end of my way. I am undone. I am defeated. I am down. There's nothing of me left. Nothing." And he clung to the angel of God. "Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities and in reproaches and in necessities. When I am weak, then am I strong. For my strength, says God, is made perfect in weakness." When we quit trying to triumph in ourselves, and our only strength is just to cling just a cling. And the angel said, "What is thy name, supplanter?" "No, not any longer. Broken now. A new man now. Thy name shall be called Israel, the Prince of God. For as a Prince of God, as a clinger now, thou shalt have power with God and with men. Thou hast prevailed." Stooping to conquer, bowing to be lifted up, humbled to be exalted. Isn't that the strangest fact of Christian experience? God's people are strong when they're on their knees, when they're broken in pieces, when they're crying to the Lord, when they're clinging to Jehovah God, when tears like showers of rain fall from their faces, when they're looking to Jesus. Power with God, power with men. And he blessed him. And Jacob called the name of that place Peniel, the face of God. For I've seen him, and my life is preserved. Oh, these things. As you read them here in the book, you'll find them just exactly like the experience that'll reverberate in your own life as you learn what it is to be a Christian, and to walk in the way of the Lord, and to grow in His love and in His patience and in His grace. For when I am weak, then am I strong. Now, while we sing this song, somebody to give his heart to the Lord, somebody to put his life in the church, a family you, or one somebody you, anywhere, while we make this appeal, on the first note of the first stanza, would you come while we stand and while we sing?